you pursuing a natural lifestyle for yourself and your family? Are you concerned about the standard American diet and options available for healthcare? Are you curious about herbs or health or already practice home herbalism? You've come to the right place. My mom, Naomi Kilbrick, is a Christian clinical herbalist and owner of Laura Chi Wellness. She teaches simple ways to live in a more healthy way and to work with plants to promote and restore health. Welcome to the Family Herbalism Podcast.
Welcome back to the Family Herbalism Podcast and to Herba Remedium students. Way back in the beginning of this podcast, I released a couple of episodes that were all about wildcrafting, and I talked about how to identify plants properly and begin working with the plants that you have available to you for your herbal medicine. But toward one of the end of those episodes, I spoke about eventually having a podcast in which I talked about proper harvesting techniques and preservation, and I never got around to it. So today, that's what we're going to be talking about. The episodes in which I featured wildcrafting topics were season 1, episodes 2, 3, and 40 primarily. Although different concepts have certainly weaved in, and recently in season 4, I spoke about wildcrafting for first aid purposes. Again, just talking about plants that are reasonably available, grow in many people's backyards, and can be worked with on a regular basis pretty safely. But I really wanted to talk about preservation because it can be one thing to properly identify a plant, but then once you've identified it, what do you do with it to make sure that you can continue working with it through the summer, through the winter, and into the next season when it becomes available again? So that's going to be my emphasis for this episode today. Now, my experience doing herb walks and identifying plants goes back a few years. I started doing herb walks for my own family and walking around my property, identifying plants and learning what we had available to us when we first moved to our new property where we live. And so that was back in 2011. But I didn't start taking other people on herb walks until 2020, which was an interesting season to begin doing herb walks with people, but it worked out well and we had great attendance. A lot of people were newly interested in herbalism given the season and the accessibility of different over-the-counter remedies and supplements and things like that. And so having this additional resource was valuable to a lot of people. And since then, I've probably led somewhere around 40 herb walks. I haven't actually sat down and counted or gone through all of my planners, but I am sure that it's right around that number. And that would have included well over 200 people altogether that I've walked either around my own property or around their properties or community areas. And so in these herb walks, we talk about how to identify and how to harvest plants correctly, how to do it safely and ethically as well. Now this year, because of the move into the new clinic space, my energy is really focused elsewhere. And so I anticipate only hosting one herb walk this summer, but my intention is to get it recorded and make it available as a class on the website, available to everyone all year round, which will actually be a great opportunity for a lot of people who are not local to me, but maybe have some similar plants growing in your area and you would like to be able to participate in an herb walk. So that's my intention for later this year. I also want to let you know about two more pieces of housekeeping before we really get started on today's topic. The first is that Herba Remedium enrollment begins next month for the Family Herbalist program, and I highly recommend that you check that out. You can visit herbaremedium.com to learn about the program, and the new year is going to be beginning end of summer, and so we are starting out enrollment next month where we bring people in for the live classes, and know that once enrollment ends, the class will remain available throughout the year as it's being released. So as the classes, live classes are recorded, they will be saved so that students who join at a later time, perhaps you're jumping in September or in November, you'll still be able to participate. And so for the students who are listening today, this is part of the program, so you already are aware of the study notes that I have available to you. If you have not enrolled yet and you're listening to this as an episode on the Family Herbalism podcast, know that I've created study notes for the students so that you can see extra information that I can't verbally pass on to you here. There are photos of the plants I'm going to be talking about today. There are extra resources and links and notes that will be helpful. So I definitely recommend you check that out if you are interested in working as your family's herbalist. Now, the other thing that I wanted to let you know too is that Town Square Herbalism, which is the group that I helped to get started, which brings together a number of herbalists who are all over the spectrum of skill and location, we're all over the country, have come together recently in the past few months to form a group where we can support each other's education and also the education of the people in our communities. And so herb walks are one of the things that we've talked about, you know, getting started in our local areas. But another resource that we've created is a monthly herb conversation where each member will take turns presenting a monograph or another form of information around a certain herb. And then we all work together to learn about this plant, experiment with recipes, try different things, and come back together at the end of the month to talk about what we've learned. So that's just part of our group and one of the many resources that we have available. And so you can learn more about that by visiting townsquareherbalism.com. And that is, again, for everyone, whether you grow herbs or whether you work at a health food store, whether you are a clinical herbalist or you are a student, we welcome everyone and we would love to have you check that out and see if it would be a good fit for the season of life that you are in. All right, so today we're talking about harvesting and preserving, and I chose to highlight two specific plants as I discuss this to really bring home exactly how this process works. And then I will also add some extra information at the end on just general, just general guidelines on how to harvest and preserve the herbs that you're working with. And the two that I've chosen today are St. John's wort flowers and raspberry leaves. I chose these because they're common in the Northeast where I live. They actually both grow on my property. And unless you have specific allergies to these, they're safe for just about everyone to work with. I also recommend finding a good quality book or books to help you identify plants correctly. Apps can come in handy, they are helpful, but having books written by people who have actually gone out in the wild and harvested these plants do definitely come in handy. They're a great resource. I love the extra tips that I find in these books that you just don't get on apps and websites. So one of my favorite books right now is Wild Plants of Maine by Tom Seymour, and I actually have quite a few copies of this on hand that I bought directly from the author. And if you would like to get a copy for yourself, you can send me an email at laureltreewellness@gmail.com. Another series that I think looks promising, although I don't own any copies personally, is the Medicinal Plants series, which is written by a few different authors, and it features plants from different regions around the United States. So we have the Southeast, the Southwest, Pacific Northwest, Midwest, Northeast, and Mountain States medicinal plants. So these can all be found where books are sold. I know they're available on Amazon. And then you can find additional suggestions on the identification process by listening to season 1, episode 3 of the Family Herbalism podcast. All right, let's talk about St. John's wort. St. John's wort in Latin is Hypericum perforatum. It was named after John the Baptist, whose birthday was reportedly June 24th. Which is during the midst of the time frame when this flower blooms. The plant is typically 2 to 3 feet tall. It has branching stems, tiny opposite leaves, 5-petaled yellow flowers that resemble a star, And as the plant ages, the stamens take on a reddish color, which makes it stand out. A key feature indicated by the name perforatum is what appears to be tiny holes around the edges of the leaves when you hold it up to the light. It only blooms for a few weeks, with the timing influenced in part by elevation. So the higher you go, the later it blooms, as with most plants. And I have certainly found this to be true on my property. We are about 750 feet, I believe, maybe a little bit shy of that, above sea level. And so it seems like it takes at least a couple extra weeks for everything to bloom around here than it does as soon as we get down into town at lower elevations. I have personally found that most patches of St. John's wort are quite small. You know, usually when you're looking at plants, you're thinking about big bushes or huge patches growing across your yard. But it seems that St. John's wort really grows in little fits and spurts here and there. And I think this is actually a good example of the doctrine of signatures, which is originally described by Paracelsus. Think about people who have depression and how they tend to avoid other people. They tend to spend more time alone. Well, one of St. John's wort's common uses is as a mild antidepressant. So I find that interesting that, just like in the case of many other plants, you can look at the behavior of that plant and how it grows and what it looks like and compare it to the many uses that it has. Now, you can harvest the whole flower head and the leaves, or you can just harvest the flowers or the petals as they bloom. Because they are sturdy plants, if you're going to dry them, you want to make sure that you dry them quickly and thoroughly before storing them, either for tea or capsules, or they may start to rot because of all of their moisture. So it needs to be done quickly. However, you can also preserve it, and you can use it fresh in tea, but you can also use fresh flowers for making tincture and oil infusions as well. When I make an oil infusion especially, I do like to wilt my flowers for a few hours because that helps some of the moisture to evaporate, and instead of being packed into your oil, and that helps to prolong the life of your oil. But dried quickly and powdered, tincture or infused in fresh, or used fresh or dried in tea are common uses, common methods of working with it. And I will get into the methods of drying and making a simple extract for St. John's wort and red raspberry after I describe each of these plants. So there are lots of ways, lots of reasons that we would work with different plants, but I'll share a couple of my favorites with you for each of these plants just for fun. St. John's wort is well known for its mild antidepressant impact on the emotions, and I do often combine it with other uplifting herbs in tinctures for clients. I also like to work with it for its nerve sedative, antispasmodic, and anodyne effects. Now, as I think it's really important to emphasize the meaning of this, a nerve sedative does not mean that it puts you to sleep, rather that it calms down overstimulation of that part of your body, in this case, the nerves. And because it's also antispasmodic and anodyne, which means that it kills pain, it can be really soothing to overstimulated, tense nerves and muscles as a consequence of the tense nerves. So when I had shingles last year, I relied heavily on it to calm down my overstimulated nerves. St. John's wort and milky oats, which we're not really talking about today, were two of my favorite things to work with for that. And in this case, I worked with the St. John's wort internally in tincture form, and I also applied it topically in oil form. I also like to work with St. John's wort in salves for basic first aid care, not just because of its pain-killing properties, but also because of its anti-inflammatory and soothing effect to the skin in general. It also has some great properties that benefit the lungs, although I've not used it in my lung formulas at this point, at least not across the board. But when it comes to salves and preparing them, the first step is making that infused oil. So we'll get to that in just a little bit. The second plant that I wanted to bring up was raspberry, or Rubus udaeus, which is part of the rose family. And oftentimes you can tell the rose family plants just by looking at the number and shape of the petals. When you look at a raspberry plant and you look at the formation of the raspberry flower petals, you'll see that all of the edges are rounded and there are 5 of them. And those are 2 very distinct characteristics of most rose family flowers. Raspberry plants often grow thickly along forest clearings and edges, in fields and along riverbanks. They do like moist earth and partial to full sun. So you don't usually see them in the woods, but you know, the earth, the ground in the woods can tend to be moist. And so that's, I think, part of the reason why it likes to grow along the edges. They grow on upright woody stems or canes, often 3 to 4 feet tall, which is actually shorter than cultivated canes. If you purchase raspberry plants and you grow them for long enough, they can get to be as tall as or taller than most adults. But usually the wild plants are much smaller, and actually the berries themselves tend to be smaller as well, which is characteristic of the wild plants versus the more cultivated kind. But I think that the wild berries tend to have a little bit more flavor packed into them. So even though they're small, the flavor can make up for that. Now, once the berries are developed, it's easy to identify the difference between red raspberry and black raspberry or blackberries. But there are other key features that you can use to distinguish the difference between these 2 helpful plants. And they actually have many similarities in their use, and for some things they really can be interchangeable. But because they have their own special strengths, I'm focusing on 1 for today. The easiest way to identify raspberry is to look at the leaf pattern at the end of the stalk. Both blackberries and raspberries have beautiful leaves occurring opposite to each other along the stalk with slightly serrated edges and ridges that are stemming from the central vein. But when they're little, there's also this really beautiful iridescent sheen that is helpful for identifying this cane from other types of canes, like wild roses also grow on canes. How can you tell the difference before the berries start showing up? Those leaves have those very marked ridges along their leaf stemming from that central vein. But then there's also that shine that stands out. It's very interesting. And then one easy feature that helps us to tell the difference between those different types of berries is the leaves at the end of the stalk. So whereas raspberry has opposite leaves all along the stalk, blackberry has 2 pairs of leaves toward the end that both connect at 1 node, just behind the leaf that's at the very tip of the branch. It makes the pairs look like an X marks the spot. And the raspberries don't have that. That's very specific for blackberry. While we can eat the raspberries and make all kinds of delicious food and drinks from them, we can also work with the leaves, the roots, and the flowers. The entire plant is useful. The leaves are really probably the 2nd most commonly used, right behind the berries. The berries are harvested mainly for food, but the leaves are harvested quite frequently for different types of tea blends. It is the leaves that women are famously told to drink a tea of during pregnancy to help tone their uteruses before birth and make the birth process easier. It was one of the first herbs that I actually learned about through the midwife that I was mentored by. As with all other plants, there are a lot of uses for red raspberry, but a few of my favorite are in tea and tincture form to help tone the pelvic organs, not just for women, but also for men. And this includes reproductive as well as urinary and digestive organs, really anything that sits inside the pelvic bowl, which has tissues that are too relaxed. Red raspberry leaves help to astringe or tighten them, which helps them to work more efficiently and comfortably. For example, prolapses, hemorrhoids, prostate inflammation, and the uterus right after birth are all examples of cases where tissues are just like, blah, not really holding themselves together anymore. And we need to have something tighten them back up again so they can work better. It also has a tightening effect on the cardiovascular system so that it can help control irregular or excessive bleeding where bleeding should be happening, and then also stop bleeding where it shouldn't be happening at all. For example, internal and external wounds. In both cases, it can be very helpful. Because it tightens up and slows down fluid loss, a lot of people like to drink a tea of it in the summer just to help slow down excess sweating. The leaves are best harvested just before the plant flowers, which is often in late May or early June, but you can really harvest them all summer long. So if you're just like, you have a situation where you could really benefit from red raspberry and you don't happen to have any dried, but you have a bush growing out back, you can work with it really at any time and you'll benefit from its medicine. But if you're looking at maximizing the medicinal quality of any plant, you really want to follow the growth of the plant. So in the very beginning of the spring, the medicine will be in the root system. And then as the plant grows, it will follow the leaf production. And then as it flowers, the medicine is primarily in the flowers. As it's developing fruit, that's where you'll find it. And then as the season progresses, it will move back down into the roots again, which is why the roots of plants are often sweetest in the fall. So that's a little interesting tidbit that can help you decide when to harvest and prepare your medicine for the winter. And so then after you've harvested them, you may want to either dry them for tea later on or dry them so that you can powderize them to make capsules, or you can use fresh or dried leaves to make the extracts, such as tinctures. Now, when it comes to drying, there are a lot of different methods that people will use, and I've experimented with quite a few. So I have my personal favorites, but I want to share seven different methods with you so that you have some choices moving forward. The first and most common these days is the electric dehydrator. And this is the one that I have zero experience with because I live off-grid, and running an electric dehydrator for the number of hours you would need in order to dry your plants thoroughly is just not reasonable for our family. So I would advise that if you are interested in using an electric dehydrator, that you refer to either the instructing manual that comes with it or someone who knows what they're doing. But generally, one thing that you will want to pay attention to is the thickness of the material you're putting in the electric dehydrator. Knowing that the thicker it is, the more water it holds, which means it's going to take more time. And regardless of how you are drying your plant, a good test to indicate whether or not it is done is when you fold a leaf or other plant material in your hand. So when you fold it in half, does it crack apart or does it just bend? If it bends, it's not dried yet. If it cracks apart, then it is dry. You definitely don't want it to be dry to the point where it's turning brown and it's completely dead, but you do want it to be snappy, crispy, or else you will be running the risk of having it be basically rot eventually before it is before it's really due time for it to lose its medicinal benefit. The second method of drying is hanging it in the rafters. This was the old-fashioned way of working with preserved herbs. And when you look up pictures on Instagram or Pinterest, you will most likely see some bunches of plants hanging from rafters or some place, you know, places around the kitchen, and it looks really pretty. And yes, this is a very valid way of drying your plants. However, you will need to be aware of dust. And it is very difficult, if not impossible, to keep dust off from your plants as they are drying and to get it off after they're finished drying. So I recommend that if you're going to hang your plants in bunches, that you do it in small bunches, more is better, and put a paper bag over them. Tie a paper bag around it so that the airflow is still going to allow for it to dry. And at the same time, it's going to keep the dust off. But I will say that this method can take a little while. So it's most likely going to be at least a week before it's done, depending on the plant and where you are located and how moist and humid your air is. The third method is a hanging dehydrator, which is similar to the hanging in the rafters method, but it is basically a netting system that holds your plants in layers, in sheets above each other, up close to the ceiling. And these can be in varying sizes. I have one that's probably about 4 feet tall when it's fully extended. And the benefit to this is that it's very similar to hanging in the rafters, except that because of the mesh, you end up with far less dust on it. And also because you don't have to bunch the stems together, it's easier for the moisture to be completely released and for it to dry faster. So I feel like it's a little bit faster than the hanging in the rafters method. But sometimes even then, it's that my plants still need a little bit of help because it can get quite humid where I live. The next one is a solar dehydrator, and these can be homemade. There's tons of videos on YouTube and elsewhere on how to build one. We had a solar dehydrator when we first moved to this property, and ours would dry plants, most plants, within 2 to 3 days if we had some decent sun. We used it for, I think it was 3 years, but at that 3 year mark, we had to stop because the bottom of the tray had started to rot and it was attracting ants. And so we could not keep the ants out of there. And of course, you don't really want to treat the wood because then you're introducing chemicals to your plants. Not such a good idea. But we have been contemplating different ideas about how to rebuild the solar dehydrator in a more effective way. Another option is trays in an aerated building. You can use a windowsill, put a baking tray, up against the window where the sunlight can come in and help to dry the plants. If you have the window open, you've got some airflow to help move that moisture that's being released. One way that I've seen plants dried is actually in a big barn. So if you have a clean-ish barn, right, where there's no animals living in there at the time, and so there's not really a lot of dust being stirred up, you can lay out tables in your open air space, leave the doors open, and allow them to dry over a few days, sometimes a bit more depending on the humidity level. This works really well for people who have large quantities of plant material that they are trying to dry. This was the method that was used at the healthcare center that I worked at years ago, where they had huge gardens and they were trying to dry vast amounts of culinary herbs. And we would just open up the barn. We had, at least four picnic table size tables that were spread end to end across this barn, and they were just full of plants. So that was kind of a fun memory to be left with, and certainly it is effective. Now, the last two that I want to mention are two that I have also used more frequently. One, this is my absolute favorite, and it's so funny. It is putting the herbs, small amounts of herbs, into paper bags, tying it up, marking it carefully so you know it's in there, and putting them in the car. If I'm not going anywhere, I will stick a bunch of paper bags in my along my dash, and it dries so fast. It's like 1 to 3 days depending on the thickness of the plants. So it works better than the hanging methods. It works when it's humid out. Plus you get the nice smell of the plants in the car, right? And it's funny, but it actually works really well. So even if you have a small home and you don't have room for a hanging dehydrator, or you don't have room for an electric dehydrator, you can always get a few sandwich paper bags and stick these plants in your car. Unless you're always driving, you might need to put them like in the back window or something so you can still see where you're going, but it works pretty well. Now, for some people who are really restricted on their options, or who live in a very humid place, a convection oven can be of assistance here. I prefer not to use the oven as much as possible because I am concerned about the quality. But if you set your oven to the lowest temperature possible and then you crack the door open, you can get your plants to finish off really fast. So I'll put them in there if it's like most of it's dry, but they're not crinkly yet. And I've already been, you know, hanging them for like 4 days, and I'm a little bit concerned about their quality. I'll just touch them off for like 5 minutes and then they're done. So I do use that toward the end to finish them off. Now, what about other methods of preservation? So that's drying them, but there's so many other things you can do with plants. And one of the most common is extracting them in a solvent or a fluid in order to save the medicinal properties, and then you discard the fiber that is left, the plant, you know, material minus its oils and minus its fluids and chemical properties. Now, this could be either hard liquor, so you got vodka and brandy and rum and whiskey, and those all work really well. You can also use either white or apple cider vinegar. You can use honey. I've used molasses. The options are endless. And there are different methods of extracting plants into these liquids. The two most common ones are the simplers method and the ratio method. Now, I'm not great at math. I can get by, and I am getting better at conversions and standard measurements for herbal remedies, thankfully, for my client's sake. But if I can get away with a simple method, that's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna take that. I'm gonna take that simple method. It's dependable for me. I know it works, and it's proven over time, and so that's what I'm gonna go with. Now, the simplers method is a traditional folk method of making infusions regardless of the fluid that you're putting into it. Instead of working with ratios, we're working with parts. It's like a slightly different language with more straightforward math rather than having to measure everything out to the gram, which I really appreciate. And my preference for this system is evident throughout my podcast because I don't just talk about making the tinctures. I also talk about making teas and other remedies using parts, which comes from the simplers method. A typical extraction using a solvent, a fluid solvent, will include one part dried plant material to three parts solvent. Now, tinctures technically are more like one part to five or seven, but when you're making an extraction, it's going to be a bit stronger. And this is really the way I make most of my products anyway, including the tincture. So if I made it myself, it was really with that 1 to 3 parts recipe. To achieve this, you would put 1 cup of dried plant material in a quart-sized jar and top it with the solvent. If you're using fresh material, you'll want to use about 3 times that amount, as much of its content is made out of water. And when you pour that liquid over the top, you're going to see it sink down and kind of even out the proportions. But the dried plant material, if you use that, is going to soak up the solvent and expand. So they end up being approximately the same amount, the same content inside that jar. Once you've poured the solvent on top and it's completely covered, you will slide a knife between the edge of the jar and the plant so that most air bubbles will escape. And you can add extra fluid if you need to so that it's nice and full. And then you will make sure that the fresh plant material is absolutely covered and close the jar. What comes next is called maceration, where the plant is essentially breaking down inside of the solvent and releasing all of its chemical properties, or a lot of them. Not all chemical properties are absorbable into all types of solvents. So if you want to get very specific about the type that you're using to make sure you're maximizing certain properties of the plant, then that will take a little extra research. But in general, for family use, for general health purposes, you can use the simplers method for basically whatever you want. So the general rule for macerating extractions using the simplers method is that you will put the jar in a dark, cool place and let it sit for about 6 weeks, turning the jar every couple of days to make sure that the material on the top and the bottom of the jar stay covered in solvent. And if at any point you see mold growing or you smell that the oil is rancid, you're going to have to throw out the whole thing, unfortunately. It's really sad when that happens, but if you've wilted your plant material beforehand, if you've made sure that your plant material is completely covered, it's less likely to occur. Now, let's say that the 6 weeks have passed. What happens next? You're going to use a fine mesh strainer or a cotton or linen cloth to strain the fluid into another jar, or you can strain it into another bowl just so that there's less spillage, and then put it back into a clean jar. And you'll notice that the fluid has taken on a different color, and it probably smells like plant material as well. Depending on what solvent you use, you might bottle this up as tincture, use it in cooking, or add it to melted beeswax, or water and emulsifying wax to make a topical solution. That's where the salve comes in. The options are really endless. There are so many recipes out there. There's so many great books with herbal recipes, but this is a general protocol you can take regardless of what you do with that infused solvent afterwards. If you keep that solvent in a tightly sealed container in a dark and cool location, or rather I should say extraction, because at this point that extraction now contains plant material. If you keep that in a dark and cool location and your container is tightly sealed, it will last a long time. Oils often keep for at least several months, vinegars usually 1 to 2 years, and tinctures that I've used 10 years later and they still work and they still taste like normal tinctures. So they last quite a while. And I did actually create an episode in season 1, episode 26, called Caring for Your Herbal Remedies. So I listed a lot more information about how to keep your herbs safe after you've preserved them and they are ready to be kept in your pantry or elsewhere in your home to be used throughout the seasons. So this is primarily just the preservation part, that process of getting those extractions ready to go for whatever use you have. If you're gonna make salve, I would recommend only using part of the oil that you've created for your salve so that you have just enough stored, because once you've used that preparation, once you've used that oil in another product and introduced other ingredients, it will degrade a little bit faster. One way out of that is to make your salves and then stick them in the freezer and pull them out as needed. I've done this quite a bit and it works well. They stay fresh, they work really well for a very long time. But if you want to extend the life of your oil without having to, you know, prepare it all into salves and then try to use those up really fast, you can just keep it as an oil extraction and in your pantry and use some as needed for your salves. If you would like to learn more about wild harvesting and you are in Maine, you can email me at laureltreewellness@gmail.com to be put on a notification list about that upcoming herb walk that I'm planning for this summer. Or you can also email me to order your copy of Wild Plants of Maine by Tom Seymour. And don't forget to check out herbaremedium.com to learn more about the upcoming Family Herbalist course, which will also lead you through the process of identifying wild plants and working with them for your family. I appreciate you being here today. I hope this episode blessed you. If it did, I hope you'll also consider sharing it with a loved one that you think would be interested in learning how to identify plants and harvest and preserve them. And you can always learn more about what I do one-on-one with clients, consulting and helping people to create wellness plans for their family by visiting www.laureltreewellnessllc.com. Have a wonderful week, you guys.
The Family Herbalism Podcast is created for educational purposes only. You are responsible for any and all medical and health decisions you choose to make. If you experience a medical emergency, please contact appropriate medical providers. To receive herbalist support, please visit www.laureltreewellnessllc.com. If you enjoy this podcast and find it helpful, please share it with your friends and family. Thank you for listening.